was a man who left the house every day at 6:30 or 7 a.m. and came home at 10:30 or 11 p.m. Any time that I got with him was time that I had to steal. He never asked me to go with him. I just went. Occasionally, he would get a call in the middle of the night, and I would hear the phone and wake up. By the time he was coming out of his room and down the stairs, I was sitting there ready to go. He would tell me to go back to my room, but sometimes he would give in, let me go with him. I remember going with him on New Year's Eve once, around 1964-65, for a maternity case. I must have fallen asleep in the doctor's waiting room. At midnight, one of the nurses woke me up. They were all pouring soda and champagne, saying, "Your father just delivered the first baby of the new year." Half asleep, I joined the celebration, knowing that it was a special thing to be there, even if my father's full attention wasn't focused on me. My mother Mary suffered from my father's inattention more than any of us. She was Irish and very beautiful. She'd been Miss Staten Island in 1940. Part of the prize that went along with the honor was a screen test to Hollywood. But her mother, my grandmother Helen Riley, called Gaga, the nickname I'd given her when I was young, had refused to let her go. "That's for tramps," she said. Who knows what direction my mother's life would have taken if she had gone. I'm sure she thought about that over the years. My mother was the complete opposite of my father. Very social, talkative, outgoing, used to getting attention, and with a fondness for nice things. My father, meanwhile, was driving around in jalopies and wearing shoes until there were holes in them, caught up in his own world and his very different concerns. When my brother Todd died at the age of 5, it pushed us all further apart. With some families, it might have helped draw them closer, not with ours. Todd had been born retarded and with an enlarged heart, and my father, who read all the medical journals and was always up on all the latest procedures, felt that an open heart surgery, which was relatively new at the time, could help him. It was the kind of thing where, if nothing was done, Todd would die by the time he was 16. So my father made the decision that he should have the operation, and he was there in the operating room watching when Todd died on the table. Years later, a woman named Sally Cusick told me that her daughter's baby had gotten sick later that same day, and my father had gone over to their house and treated the baby. When Sally Cusick found out that her daughter had called my father, she was upset. She said, "You called Dr. Atlas? Didn't you know his son died today?" Her daughter was devastated. "I didn't know," she said. "He came and he never said a thing." That was my father to a T. He never said a thing. My mother was devastated by Todd's death, as she held it against my father that he had pushed for the operation. In the aftermath, she had what I would call now a breakdown. For a while, she was even taking a blanket down to Todd's grave and sleeping there. Truthfully, I don't remember much about that time, but I think about the irony of it, how in our family where feelings were neglected, this kid, my brother, had an enlarged heart and it turned out to be a death sentence for him. There was a period after Todd died when my brothers and sister and I lived with relatives and friends. It was around that time that my mother's drinking really became a problem. It probably wouldn't be fair to lay the blame for her drinking on Todd's death or my father's neglect, since alcoholism ran in her family, but those things certainly didn't help. 10 o'clock on a Wednesday. I'm in my room, doing homework. From downstairs comes a scream. "You bastard, you don't even care." I hear the sound of dishes being broken. I close my eyes, wishing it would stop. It keeps going, the yelling keeps going, the crash of dishes. Finally, a door slams, and there is silence. I go out of my room and down the stairs. My father comes out of the kitchen, looks at me. "Dad, it's okay, go back to your room." He walks past me and up the stairs. I stand there for a moment, then go into the kitchen. The entire floor is covered with broken dishes. The overhead cabinets are open. I get some paper shopping bags out of the drawer by the sink and start picking up shards of china and crockery. By midnight, the kitchen is spotless. I've cleaned up all the evidence. The next day in school, I don't say anything to my friends. I don't want anyone to know. It's better if I keep it inside. By the time I was in my late teens, I was starting to get into trouble. At Curtis, the public high school,